Hey, everybody, and welcome back to a new episode of the China Startup Pulse. I am your host, Ryan Shukin, and we're here to look at the startup scene and investment scene here in China. And today we do that and beyond because this company has not just changed what growth and scaling and biking means in China, but it's doing it globally. It is Mobike. And we sit here with Florian Bonheur, who is an incredible person. He is the head of global partnerships for Mobike. He was employee number 37. He not only breaks down the list of important items that had to be right for Mobike's success, but he gives us advice on how hard we should push, where we should be focusing on, and his own story about his journey to join Mobike and be part of that is fantastic. This is an absolute great episode with his own experience highlighting some of the most important lessons that you can learn here in China. This is going to be a not just incredible episode that's a little bit longer than usual, but we might even break this up in two parts. We'll see. This is fantastic. Without any further ado, let's get into it and hear from Florian ourselves. Cheers, guys. Hey, everyone. I am here with Florian Bonheur.
Sounds great. I wouldn't have said better myself.
Oh, Florian, thank you so much. We're so excited to have you here. Florian is a multi-international individual who grew up not only in France, the Caribbean, the U.S., and now a child of China. His background is in mechanical engineering, you know, building stuff and making things sustainable for the world and the environment, which is something that you're really big into, right?
Definitely. It's one of my personal brand's pillar.
Yeah. And you worked doing, when you first came to China, he worked doing quality control.
Yeah.
Like looking at the factory line items going off and making sure that they weren't deformed. These toothbrushes and dolls.
Exactly.
I don't know. And then you worked at a German OEM doing machine parts. And you talk about how that started to get you thinking about, you were optimizing things you wanted to build, and you started your first startup in 2013 in China called WeSmart, which was, if I get this right, a SaaS platform for measuring multi-fluid inputs for companies and optimizing their electricity and fluid outputs.
That is
close?
Correct.
Oh.
It's overcomplicated, but it's correct.
But then this led to you becoming the 37th employee at Mobike.
Yeah.
And right now your title at Mobike?
I'm head of global partnerships for Mobike.
Absolutely delighted to have you here.
Thank you very much.
And your story, I really am excited for everyone to hear this and to go through about how you transitioned and built this. I mean, right now, give me an idea of what Mobike is and what you guys are doing globally.
Mobike is the world's first dockless bike share platform. So the company was created in January 2015.
And we got to talk about what dockless bike share is. Because
right.
When I say, oh, I just use a Mobike to get to work, people are like, oh, but I hate finding the stations
right.
to put it there. I go, no.
Right. So I'll tell you a little bit story to highlight this. My own mother, who obviously knows that I work for some Chinese company called Mobike, and she's known for 2 years now, right? Because I call her regularly.
Yeah.
It took her about a year of me pitching it to her, and most importantly, a trip to China.
Yes.
And a trial on the Mobike to actually like return the bike somewhere, lock it and look at me and be like, oh yeah, now I get it. Like I understand the impact and the convenience and the reliability of the whole system.
Exactly.
And so what she understood in that moment was the fact that not having those specific points to pick up the bike and drop off the bike is a huge game changer. So schemes in Paris like Vidib or in Washington, D.C., like a Capital Bike Share or a City Bike in New York or whatever, these are great and they can get to some kind of scale, dozens of thousands, but they still have those individual docking stations that cost a lot of money, that are inconvenient for the users, et cetera, et cetera. So Mobike, on the other hand, is a dockless system because it's got there are no stations, there are no docks. So you locate the bikes through the app, you unlock them through the app, you pay through the app, everything is digital, and then you return them to any authorized parking location, which are widely available, especially compared to those expensive stations that you have to build.
Incredibly convenient, one of the most wonderful things. And tell me about what you guys are positioned globally right now and what your growth is.
So we started in April 2016 in Shanghai. The expansion in China was relatively fast. We went to about 200 cities within 2 years. Now globally, we're in
relatively fast. Okay,
relatively fast.
It took out 200 years in America to go to 2,200 cities.
I say relatively fast because recently I hear about this new coffee delivery model.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And that company even beat that score. I mean, I think they're in 400 cities now, and it's been a year or something. Please don't quote me on the figures, but their figures are even more impressive.
Yeah, yeah. So China's a different game changer, but relatively to the world, you know, 0 to 200 cities.
Yes.
And with how many, let's say, devices or bikes, however you call them?
So again, when I joined, it was April 2016. Yeah. It was the week that we launched operations in Shanghai. They trialed with 200 bikes. Mm-hmm. I think on launch day, we had a couple thousand. And then we ramped up production. We got different factories. We've got different production channels as well. Mm. We're working with Foxconn, et cetera, et cetera. And today it's 9 million bikes globally.
9 million bikes globally. Oh my God. This is, yeah, which is, you know, you're going to say a moderate 9 million.
It's relatively big.
Oh man, the things that are happening here. This is absolutely incredible. I mean, this growth in this company has been something that's been turning heads globally.
Yes.
All over the world.
Yes.
So where have you guys expanded and how have you guys done that?
The first country that we ever launched abroad was under my leadership, if I may say so, because I'm the one who went to Singapore in summer 2016 for the first time. And then we built the company there, hired the team, built the P&L, the business model, everything, brought the bikes over. Mm-hmm. And we launched Singapore on March 21st, 2017. Mm-hmm. So just like 11 months after we started operating in China. And then following that, we launched a bunch of countries, including UK, Italy, US, Mexico, Chile. And today it's 16 countries outside of China.
16 countries.
Including India, Korea, Japan, Malaysia.
These are fantastic markets. Yeah.
Basically, if I may add one thing about the vision behind the company is that it's very culturally agnostic. Mm-hmm. Everyone basically on Earth, most people know what a bike is. Most people know how to ride one. And it doesn't really matter what language you speak or even what payment method you use or what kind of city you live in. As long as there's a road and a bike, you're going to want to use it.
Yeah.
Because you need to go from A to B. And it doesn't matter if you're Indian, French, or American. You need to have a means of getting around that is reliable, comfortable, and affordable and convenient.
And I will say that, you know, they say you ride a bike, you never forget. Once you ride a bike, you never forget. Once you ride a mobike or just a shareless bike, you never forget that.
You can't go back.
You can't go back. Because there's so many other things that like, hey, where am I going to park it?
Yeah.
I have to go back and get it. Where's my lock? You know, where do I tie it up? Mm-hmm. All this stuff, where do I put it? Mm-hmm. Bringing it back, the maintenance and everything. And you guys have great bikes. Like, this is such a wonderful role that you're in. And there's so much talk about mobike, but there's a lot to talk about you. And I really want to try to get to the core of how you became the entrepreneur that helped get this opportunity and grow it globally. And you said that you first came here doing quality check. Mm. I mean, that seems like one of the furthest things from actually running and going global with one of the fastest growing companies. And so what were the pillars and what were, you know, your entrepreneurship journey through, I guess, building this and what happened at WeSmart?
When you look at it like this, there is indeed a big difference between checking quality defects on mugs in backyard factories in Shenzhen and exporting high quality bikes to 16 countries across the world.
Absolutely.
But there is one key element that is that still the manufacturing is still there.
Yeah.
So whether you manufacture toothbrushes or mugs or toys or whatever,
a
mobile.
So you're still doing quality checks.
When I went to the factory, the first
it's
time
full
when
circle.
Exactly. But at least it gave me that background, like that culture. When I walked into the mobile factory for the first time, I wasn't discovering a factory because I worked in factories before. I've seen them and big and small and everything. And it just helps a lot. Like understanding what an assembly line is and the different stations and time per part, per bike. And like these were the kinds of questions that I was asking my colleagues the first time I went to the factory. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't help a lot to have this knowledge in my mind when I go and talk to the mayor of a city or like to the government authority in Singapore. Like they don't really mind how the bike is manufactured, but it's good knowledge. It's, and I come from a technical background, but I've always worked in sales and marketing and this kind of stuff. But I always believe that it's good to have a technical understanding of something to then go out and sell it or to promote it. Like I value the technical background.
Yeah. But how did you buckle down to like to then go from engineering, like you were saying, going, you were very technical into doing your own thing.
Because now looking back over the past 10 years, it's very easy to connect the dots, but it's obviously much harder to see ahead and try to connect the dots that are still ahead of you. It's always easy to build a story looking back because you find the common elements and the different experiences and the different things that happened.
I should have done this. I should have seen this. And it's 2020 vision. It's 2020 hindsight.
But I don't believe in that.
Yeah.
I don't believe in that. So, but I did and I tried. But after a while, when I realized that it didn't work, at least not for me, I thought about it in a different way, which was to, if I, you know, telling myself, if I can't find out what is exactly right for me, I will very precisely label what is wrong for me.
Yeah.
And so I worked in quality control. It was great, but I knew that I wouldn't do that another day for a number of reasons. Then I worked in the OEM manufacturing. It was great. I learned a bunch of stuff. About manufacturing, about, you know, being the only foreigner in a Chinese company, et cetera, et cetera. But I wasn't going to do that anymore either. Mm-hmm. And then again, WeSmart was amazing, but we had a few Chinese employees and mostly foreigners. Again, that was great, but I wasn't going to do that anymore because I was always drawn to something else. Mm-hmm. So that's how I just took step after step, just by identifying very precisely what I didn't want to do and going towards what was left.
You know, I actually really strongly believe in this idea as well, because how in the world am I going to know exactly what I want when I'm 16, 17, 18? I even have this problem with trying to decide what you're going to do for the rest of your life when you're that young and picking your major in school and doing it forever. I know exactly what I don't like. And you know that you're hopeful to find the path and the things that you love. And, you know, getting out and experiencing, I guess, as much as you can gives you the best chance, right? It's all about the best chance. Yeah. How did you find, or what was it like when you found or saw the thing that you wanted? Maybe that was Mobike. Maybe that was something. What was that moment?
There are a couple of moments. I can focus on two that really spring to my mind right now. The first one is the first time I came to Asia because ever since I was, you know, 3, 4, 5, whatever, I was fascinated with Asia and not with a specific country, just with pop culture, you know, like Dragon Ball Z and paper folding and origami and judo. I played judo for like 10 years and I just had all those things in mind. And for me, Asia was just so mysterious and so attractive. And I had grown up in the US, so I had a good idea of Europe, US, but the rest of Asia, for me, for some reason, was just mystery and like samurai. Like, I want to go and meet a samurai, you know?
Walking down the street. Everyone can fly over there and throw kamehamehas.
Exactly. So the first time I walked down the street in Shenzhen 8 years ago, I was like, oh, why don't people do kung fu in the street? Very stereotypical thing. Yeah. But like, that is why I went there, because I believe that everyone here did kung fu and everyone was like Bruce Lee and everyone read manga. And obviously it didn't turn out to be true. But I discovered a whole other part of my life.
Yeah.
And so to answer your question, the first wah moments, the first kind of realization was when I had the chance to go to Asia, because I was always so fascinated by this part of the world and I had no idea, no clue at all what it was like, what people were like, what business was like, nothing. So when I had the first chance to go, I was like, wow, that was a big wow moment. And then the second wow moment was Mobike. And that's very recent. Now I'm jumping 8 years. But looking back on the progress that we've made over the past 2 years has definitely changed a lot of my thinking and the way I look at things and the way I also criticize, for example, my best friend's project or something. Yeah. Like, he's got an idea that I support. I love it. But then I ask him questions like, how about scalability?
Yeah, because you've seen scale on the massive
scale. How many have you sold so far? And how many do you want to sell in a year? And it's just a very different way of looking at things. And I guess that's what you call a little bit of experience. And that has been a big wow moment, because Mobike's a unicorn.
And that last wow moment happened 2 years ago.
Or even less.
I mean, people are saying that China's slowing down, that its double-digit growth is gone, the steam, the opportunity. Like, do you feel like this is still the land of the unicorn and the growth and the potential? You know, because 2 years ago, this was obviously, you saw that and you jumped on it. Is it right now still? And in which way has it continued?
Yes. For me personally, it's still definitely the land of whatever you want to call it. If you want the land of the unicorn, for me, yes. You've got a number of books that look at this from a geopolitical point of view. Mm-hmm. It seems that the geopolitical center of the world is shifting towards the east. I think most people would agree with that. that's going to play to the number of unicorns globally and to where they're headquartered. Now, if China will be the center in the next 10 or 50 or 100, like, I don't know, you got Indonesia and India and a bunch of other economies, but the East for sure. Mm-hmm. And then if you're talking about numbers like annual GDP growth or whatever, I often joke, but my country's growth is 0 point something.
Yeah, 0 point
something. In the best cases.
Yeah.
And I wish for it to grow. And I believe we have the capability and we as French people, like we can do it. I believe, you know, I'm not being purely French and just criticizing. I'm
Hey,
just
French
saying
tech
that
movement is huge globally right
now.
The French tech entrepreneurship movement is killing it. I remember 5 years ago, if I saw a person in tech that was French, I was like, oh, you're an outlier. Mm-hmm. And then 2 years later, I said, oh, everyone that I'm meeting is someone from France in tech.
Definitely. Definitely. Macron said very positive stuff about AI recently and blockchain, ministers of economy. Like there's a real, real drive. I'm really happy about it.
And you're actually an impactful person leading this charge for French tech. I mean,
abroad. Yeah.
Yeah. Abroad. You know, you are leading the charge in one of the fastest growing and scaling companies globally right now.
I wish I soon gets the Legion d'honneur.
Yeah.
Do you know the Legion d'honneur?
I hope it's like a giant cross that you can wear.
It's a distinction.
It's a distinction?
It's an official French governmental distinction. So for my work at Mobike, if anyone's listening.
Yeah. Come on, Macron. I know you're a listener.
There we go.
All right. Come on. Okay. Let's get a little bit into Mobike and what you've done at Mobike and some of the challenges in that. Because I don't believe any, well, maybe you can help me, but telling to 200 cities and you said 16 countries?
16, yes. We launched India 2 days ago.
That's superhuman. And you launched India 2 days ago. Yeah. So, you know, you don't get taught this.
Nope.
Somebody doesn't sit you down on, you know, hey, son, this is how you scale in 16 countries in 2 years and 200 cities. So how did you, one, find your fit working at Mobike, which is a Chinese, culturally Chinese company as a foreigner? And then two, find your, let's say, you know, your rhythm, your ability to execute and grow on this scale. Because like this is something, you know, when we look at it, it's unique. It's unique to you. It's unique to what you guys have done.
For the first one, it was given to me. I had it already. For the second one, it was forced upon me. I'll go into a little
bit
more detail.
I'd love to hear the first one.
The first one was given to me because I mentioned the fact that I was so passionate about Asia.
Yes.
And then I did manufacturing, did OEM, did this, did that. Loved everything, but not for me. I want to do something else. And then same thing with the French team and the previous company and WeSmart. That was great. We could have scaled that so much more. But I wanted to work with only Chinese colleagues because having three French co-founders is great. But sometimes I would rather be doing a podcast in English than in French.
Yeah.
That kind of.
Yeah.
So joining 36 other Chinese colleagues for me was as exciting as the idea of the dockless bike share.
I love it.
It was really the thing. And when I sat down on the computer the first day, I remember very clearly the first email I wrote, like all Chinese characters, took me an hour to write it.
Yeah.
And then in the first, you know, in the first few months, like reading my mails would take me 2 hours per day or something, because obviously like it's all in Chinese.
Everything's in Chinese.
Yeah. And then being available 24/7 on WeChat and just all the cultural and language processes that go behind this. Like that was one very, very important thing for me from a cultural point of view, from a social point of view. That's what I wanted to experience. So that's why I say it was given, is because it's what I wanted in the first place.
Yeah.
Then the speed and the company culture and everything, I kind of joke, but I'm putting quotes around this this answer that is what it was forced upon me. But we've got like a very strong founding team. They each have at least like 15 years experience. Davis, the CEO, worked in Procter & Gamble and Google, and the CTO worked in Ford and Chrysler. Like they've got a lot of very strong, very good experience. So, and especially Davis, because of his personality, I always saw him like knowing where he was going.
Yeah.
He would say something in April of 2016. And then at the end of 2016, it would magically come true. And like he knows what he's talking about. Like it's not his first rodeo.
That's
so when he tells you, you know, daily marketing meeting at 6 p.m. For like 3 months or 2 months or whatever, like first of all, you go there and you work your ass off and you do it because you believe in the idea, you believe in the guy, you believe in your team, you just do it. And like other stuff doesn't really matter. You know, when people who are not entrepreneurs or not in that field ask me, like, how is it working on Sunday and whatever? And I'm sure you would agree with that answer. It's just, it's not really working. If it is working, if it feels like working, if you don't want to do what you're passionate about on Sunday afternoon, there's obviously an issue somewhere.
Yeah.
So you don't mind working your ass off 14 hours a day or 18 hours or like however long it takes. It doesn't matter. You just do it because that's what you're passionate about. Mm-hmm. And that was very much how it felt in the beginning. And now, of course, it's changed. It's much bigger, but there's still that passion. There's still that drive of people to just love the brand and go out and do cool stuff.
I mean, was there ever a moment where, like in the journey that you took, was there ever a moment where you were thinking, okay, I'm like, I imagine other people listening to this podcast and thinking, oh my God, he was excited to go to a different country and join a team in a completely different language with super high expectations.
Yeah.
You know, 2 hours to just write one email. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Do you look upon it now and realize how crazy this was? You say it to me, I you know, he's grinning, you know, he is super excited as he's saying how much probably joyful pain that you put yourself through.
Exactly.
But this is crazy, right?
It is crazy, but because it's linked to a passion, it's acceptable. It's okay. Yeah. And for example, you know, I'm thinking about sports. Like some people go to the gym 2 hours per day and they really enjoy it.
Yeah.
And I get that. I'm not that person, but I get that.
What are you talking about? You look fit. You look good.
Oh, thank you. And my voice sounds amazing.
Yeah. Trust me. He's a bodybuilder, guys. You can't see it, but I'm saying it.
It's just, you know, whatever your passion is, it's going to be easy to put in the hard work and put in the thing. When part of my American heritage is all the media industry and the Kevin Harts and the Dwayne Johnson and the Rock and everything. It sounds kind of cheesy when you say it sometimes. No offense, The Rock, if you're listening, but you know, just put the work
definitely
in, put the passion in.
Definitely a listener.
And you're going to get there. And it's hard for me to embrace that sentence when you're talking about the gym or lifting weights. But when you're talking about learning a language or writing on an email in a tongue that's not your mother tongue, then yeah, I'm done with that.
And how much of a factor in your life was showing up, like coming to China or being here? Could someone do this? Could someone build something like this somewhere else? Or do they need to be in China to see this? Like, what is the importance of that aspect?
I strongly believe that being here is very, very, very important. Mm. I would like to highlight the fact that if one is not in the country or the region that they want to expand a business to, it might work.
I mean,
but you're not putting all the chances on your side. And I unfortunately saw that in the first company in WeSmart, where we did good, but had we all been here working around the clock and almost lived in the same apartment, like you don't have to work to live in the same apartment, but it helps.
Yeah.
And it's no wonder that all those crazy success stories start out from a couch, from a sofa, it's, you know, I get it, but it's extremely important. And since you asked the question, I'd like to add something a little bit more detailed about this is not only coming here, but then embracing the language and the culture.
Mm. Yeah. Get into that. Because I've talked to so many entrepreneurs here and there's always some special element. So I want to hear what you say.
For me, the language is so important. It's so important. And if you come here and you stay 5 years or 10 years or however long and you don't speak Chinese, that's fine. Like I'm not going to think of you less or whatever. But again, you're not putting all the chances on your side. Some people come here and they've got certain jobs that don't require Chinese. All their colleagues speak perfect English. They don't have the time to learn Chinese because they've got families and kids and soccer on the weekend and everything. Like I get that. But again, you're not putting all the chances on your side. So if you come here and you really want to be successful, learning Chinese is such an important part of everything.
I'd say for investors and for startups, you come here, even if you don't know how to, let's say, converse, memorize your pitch in Chinese as if it was a song, like KTV karaoke, memorize your pitch in Chinese. Like this can be a world of difference. Then all the investors will come to me like, oh, that was great, blah, 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 blah. And you won't understand a word of it, but you now have the meeting.
Exactly. Because you're not trying to converse. I mean, if you're not willing to commit 2 years of your life to study every day, then you know, you're not trying to converse. That's not what you're doing. What you're trying is trying to build a connection.
Yeah.
To trying to meet people, trying to build a persona, a personal brand, or just whatever. And yeah, you can learn a few Cheng Yu, a few idioms, and then, you know, make people laugh and they'll feel closer to you. And whether it's entrepreneur or investor, that is wildly important.
Yeah. Or you can jump into the deep end with you and just jump into a Chinese company.
Oh yeah, you could do that. Yeah, you could do that too. Yeah. If you've got nothing to lose.
Yeah. So I want to kind of talk about or get your feedback on how Mobike has built this success globally, because a lot of people don't really understand not just what Mobike is. They kind of get it's a bike, but they don't understand how Mobike could do this. You know, is it the business model? Is it the need was so great and no one saw it? I mean, I feel like if Uber owns the world, then this was an opportunity in their backyard and they missed it.
Mobike got so big so fast because it met a very long list of criteria, including stuff that ranges from obvious to not really relevant, but I really believe it is somehow relevant.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like the perfect storm.
Yeah.
And basically Mobike had the right ecosystem, had the right government support, the right infrastructure. It's easy to ride a bike in Shanghai. It's very easy. And in Beijing and in so many other Chinese cities.
Hey, China's called the bicycle kingdom for a reason.
China has been the bicycle kingdom, and now there's the revival of the bicycle kingdom. Like people... Everyone has seen a lot of people riding bikes, whether they're older people than they used to ride bikes themselves, whether they're younger people, they graduated, bought a BMW, but still saw their grandparents ride their bikes to buy groceries. Like there's the cycling culture.
Absolutely.
From a more tech point of view, the ubiquity of smartphones.
Yeah.
Like you can go out there and buy a Xiaomi for 400 RMB, for $50 US, you can buy a smartphone in China.
Good smartphone too.
And a good smartphone too. The ubiquity of digital payments.
Yes. Now this digital payments on a level like you've never seen.
Yes. WeChat, 1 billion, over 1 billion users, right? WeChat Pay.
Yes.
Not 1 billion just yet, but hundreds of millions just with a credit card linked to their smartphone accessible like instantly.
Yeah, your smartphone becomes your bank account and your ability to pay out.
Exactly.
Done.
FYI, I was just paying a bill right before I got here. And I had 60 yuan in bills, in cash. Mm-hmm. And I told the waiter, like, please help me get rid of this.
Yeah,
because I don't want bills anymore.
Yeah.
I never touch bills.
Fast.
Yeah, it's crazy. You have actual coins and bills in your hand like once a month or something.
Yeah,
literally.
Yeah. No, it's true.
And so a long, long list, you know. And of course, the team, the experience of the team, the prototype, the service was quite good. The app worked.
What about the
course,
model? You know? I mean, the model is crazy. I use a Mobike and then because I go to work every day using a Mobike, really. And it was the first bike when they first started. I started using them and I would my fiance and I would do Sunday rides around. We have scooters. We have everything. Mm-hmm. We would use a Mobike to just go around the town and just slowly bicycle because we didn't have anything.
Yeah.
And this is when the first bikes came out when the seats were real low and my knees were real high.
Yeah.
But like I remember those days.
Yeah.
But like the model, you know, I would do that 1 RMB. Maybe 2 RMB for an entire ride.
Before I talk about the model, I want to add something to the list of criteria
because everything
I mentioned was quite straightforward and business related. And they're just basically KPI, stuff you have to check.
Okay.
And there's a checklist. But what you said just now also made me remember that there's a whole intangible part to the success of the story. And the idea that people think they're cool when they ride the bike, including myself.
Yeah.
That was hugely important to the success of the company.
Because can you describe the bike?
It's made out of aluminum entirely. Well, first of all, it doesn't look like a bicycle. So if you start to imagine a Mobike, don't think of a traditional bicycle.
Exactly.
Get that image out of your head. Then picture some car wheels, bright orange, 5 spokes. And imagine someone kind of like cruising down Miami Beach.
Yeah.
That's the kind of the attitude. And you see, my point just now was to highlight the fact that it's cool to ride a Mobike. And that's the first image that pops in my head is the
people
fact that
are gonna
you look cool, you know?
The spokes and the wheels are different. Everything's different.
It's made out of aluminum and the shape is really unique and you don't have a chain. There are a couple of technical things. There's about 100 patents on the bike that make it kind of
100 patents on the bike itself. The thing that has been around for, you know, time immemorial, the bicycle,
200 years,
and you've got 100 patents on.
Yeah, including like the lock, the embedded software, the onboard electronics, the transmission, the mud guard. The mud guard has a patent.
Yeah,
a bunch of stuff. So really trying to highlight the fact that it looks very unique, and that was kind of an intangible factor, but it was so crucial to the idea actually working out, because the whole goal was to reduce the barrier to entry for anyone to get on the bike.
Yes.
Because when you talk to people, or when you do a market analysis or whatever, who would say no to something that is cheaper, faster, and better than being crammed in the bus?
Yeah.
I think everyone would agree. But then there's still a barrier to entry, which is, well, actually getting the person on the bike because they're not used to it. And in order to further lower that barrier to entry, having a bike that looked really cool was a very, very important element. Mm-hmm. And so I'm telling this whole story because you reminded me of that when you said you went down on Sunday and just cruised around with your fiance, because I can see that happen. My best friend and his girlfriend also did that. And he had an electric scooter and she had her own bike. Mm-hmm. And so at first they were like, meh, yeah, it looks cool, but I wouldn't be your typical user. I'm like, okay. 6 months later, I see them riding Mobike together.
Yeah.
It's because again, it's so convenient and it works and it's fun.
Yeah. Yeah, it's absolutely. Yeah. And this is, so the model though, I want to jump back on that.
Yes.
So let's talk about the model. So I've had a lot of late night conversations actually about Mobike's model. Because this model has become a global phenomenon.
Yeah.
I have likened Mobike's model to literally the blockchain of hardware. You have taken something, and you don't even need a blockchain for it, but you've commoditized. Mm-hmm. You've opened on an open ledger. Anyone can see it. Open there, everybody. Bicycles, a real piece of hardware. Yeah. And I think it's one of the first times I've ever seen that and been able to experience the technology and the system that allows this to happen. I mean, I'll explain a little bit, but I want to hear from you the model. Like, why this model? And how does this model work, really? Because it seems like an RMB a day, how much does it really add up to?
The model was there before. When you think of those soda vending machines, it's physical assets that are put out there in the wild, and they've got the branding and they're able to make money on their own. And sometimes they need maintenance. They need like the supply chain to refill the drinks and everything. Mm-hmm. Like, that's basically the same idea, right?
Yeah.
The major differences between a soda vending machine and Mobikes is that we have a lot more. They can be put in a lot more places and they move around.
Yep.
So it's dynamic, right? The vending machine is going to stay in the same place. But like the original idea of the business model, I feel is not that crazy. It's just not that out there. And then to answer your question more specifically, why is it ¥1 per half hour? It's because, again, we wanted to lower the barrier to entry.
Yeah.
So in Shanghai and China, generally speaking, one bus trip is ¥2.
Yes.
And we wanted to encourage people to take the bike.
Yeah.
So when you're a startup and you're bold and you have angel funding and Series A and then more, well, you know, you go at one per half hour, because you have to be lower than two and you're not going to go for 0.735. So you just go at one, you know?
Yeah, exactly. You're angel funded and back. But you know, the funny thing is that this is so different and stark difference from still a lot of like Silicon Valley investors. Even if you were A funded, they'd be like, no, we're A funded for you to show that revenue, to show that something else. But in China, there's a different expectation. And the model is different because people, there's, you know, you're fighting against other things here. You know, like I've seen that.
I can't say a lot about the revenue model. What I can say, just to add on the previous question, is that yes, ¥1 per half hour is little. It's not much. But we also have, on average, 30 million trips per day. So obviously it depends on the season, of the day of the week, and a number of criteria, but on average it's 30 million trips. So if one trip is ¥1, that's like $5 million per day.
Yeah.
So it's not a little money. And second of all, and to kind of take a step back and bring it back to the China scale, there is a tendency here in China from the government to give the space to startups to expand and try and iterate and maybe fail, maybe succeed. But from a regulatory point of view, including amongst other things, there is space.
Yeah.
Obviously, it depends on the industries and you
there's
know, the
support,
ICO regulation
support,
and everything.
There's tons of support that's really coming through.
Yes. Not only do they allow, but they also support if it's the right industry. Mm-hmm. If you've got an entrepreneur tomorrow that comes in and has got a great solution for the environment, like he's going to be able to get government support. So, of course, nothing's easy, but it's going to come. So, if it's for education or whatever is good for the future of the country,
it's going to be there.
It's going to work for sure. And in the case of bike sharing, we reduce congestion by like 13%, 12%, 15% in cities. There's
congestion.
A number.
You have all of these benefits. I had no idea.
Yeah. So
it's huge.
If people check my LinkedIn, there are a number of white paper that we put out. We reduce the blind spots by like 99%+. So blind spots in transportation. So within 500 meters, access to
first
and last mile. So like 99%. We increase the average car speed during rush hour because there are less cars on the road. We shift the modal use from less cars to more bike. Mm-hmm. In Singapore, over the past year, we doubled the modal share of cycling.
Oh my God.
So there are a number of figures that are just incredibly positive for the city.
How much health have you brought to your users?
In the last report, again, long story short, $200 million.
Really?
Yeah. Like we did a study of quantifying the positive externals.
Yeah, positive externals. So like people are having less heart attacks because of Mobike.
Exactly.
I mean, I'm making a big statement there. It's not just Mobike. It's all these bikes.
Of course.
It's the shared economy for this. But like as a driver getting out there and you know, not sitting on a scooter, not sitting on a bus, you're moving.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I love to see more of that because you're making positive impact in such a big space.
Yeah.
So I can't imagine anyone using a Mobike and not going back to their own home city and demanding that they have this. So is there a on the ground movement? Are people demanding? Are cities realizing globally that they need this? What's happening?
Yeah, there are a couple of things. Again, I'm going to start with a little plug, but if you go to my LinkedIn.
Yeah, let's do it.
I don't think it's on my LinkedIn, but it might be on YouTube, but there's a video
If you're going to give your LinkedIn, what is your LinkedIn?
Just Florian Bonner. I guess it'll be in the description.
Done. Yeah, it'll be in the description. Good. Just so everyone can check right now.
Yeah. Florian, FLORIANBOHNERT.
Excellent.
There's a video that's called Mobike, Please Come to My City. Or What If Mobike Came to My City?
Really?
And then there's a girl from New York. There's a guy from Brazil. There's a French girl. There are a bunch of different people that all live in Shanghai that are used to having Mobike and that just tell their experience and how they would love Mobike to go back to their own city.
Yeah.
And I love that video because, again, it bridges like the social and the tech and it's got a human feel to it. It's not only about the product and the features and the app and the big data. Like there's a social element to it.
Yeah.
I love that video so much. And it really embodies what you're trying to say right now, what you said just now.
Yeah.
And so from the city's point of view, a couple of other things I can mention, the ECF, European Cycling Federation.
Mm-hmm.
I met with them for the last time early February of this year, and they were preparing a report only on dockless bike share.
Yeah.
And that report is destined to guide and advise governments on what they should do, like on what is out there, what are the different providers, the different solutions, what are the advantages of dockless, what it used to be before. And, you know, so that's one thing. You've got like third parties that create reports to educate cities. You've got cities who proactively reach out to us. So we've got a number of cities who literally send me an email saying, I'm the deputy mayor for whatever city in charge of cycling. And
like to
and
invite you
let's
to come
talk
on over
about bringing Mobike over to our country, you know,
because I'm a podcast addict and I was listening to a podcast just recently, very timely. I think it was like 2 days ago, and it was about the Taxi King of New York.
Mm-hmm.
The Taxi King is this guy who owned 1,000 taxi medallions.
Okay.
And so in the back in the, it's still today, New York City, it limits the amount of taxis, public transport taxis that are allowed out there by these medallions. And these medallions are a fixed economy. Is something like this happening to the bike share economy? Is something, are cities coming in and saying, hey, we're going to use this taxi method or some other method to try to control and regulate? Or are you really able to go in and grow as you need? Like what's happening globally?
Just a few words within China. As we mentioned before, it was very much go out there, try stuff. We learn from it. We always keep in touch with the government. We share our learnings with them. Then regulation comes into place that is basically based upon the learnings that we had.
Yeah.
And so that's what's happening. And so now Shanghai, Beijing, Guangzhou all have official regulations that we follow, that we actually help.
You helped build.
To build, to put in place, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Singapore is relatively similar. They also had kind of a wait and see approach, and now they're also working with them to put in place a reglement, the regulation. It's fairly similar to China. Outside of those two countries, and you know, from my personal experience and to kind of generalize, it really depends. You've got cities that are going to welcome almost as many companies as they can. So some cities in the US have four or five different providers.
Wow.
And they do control through the number of bikes that we can operate and through a number of different things, but they're fairly open-minded to having more bikes.
Yeah.
Other cities, for example, a city in Australia, I remember it was before the first bike share company got there. They had already released what I like to call the rules of the game. So they looked at what happened globally. Maybe they took a trip to Shanghai to experience it firsthand. And then they just put out the rules of the game. So they said, us as a city, we believe that it's important to promote cycling. So we're going to roll out like 4,000 or X thousand additional bike parking spaces. We're going to do that at our own cost because we want to promote cycling. At the same time, we welcome the bike share companies to come in, but they have this and this rule to follow. You can't have broken bikes. You can't have bikes in the middle of the street, and et cetera, et cetera. And then the final thing that I love so much was at the bottom of the paper, and it's only like three or four pages. It's like really simple, very straightforward, but it works beautifully. And then the last thing I remember is if the user, if the citizen has any issues with the bikes, contact the bike share operators. Don't contact the government. Don't contact the city. Because we can't expect to go somewhere and then have the city help us rebalancing. Like, we want to work together with them, of course, but we're the operator. We're responsible. And so we're going to be the ones who are going to operate the bikes. And so they understand that very clearly. And they said, you know, if any user has any issue, contact the bike share operator directly. And it works out beautifully. Like, people in Sydney ride the bikes and everybody's happy. So there's just a wide panel of behavior amongst the different cities worldwide. It really depends.
I mean, I'm going to say that I've been in London. And I've seen the bikes there, Singapore and Sydney. And
you've been everywhere.
And I have seen all the bikes, but I have also seen in each one of those places a bike promiscuously placed in a tree, typically in a tree.
Typically in a tree, but not always in a tree.
Not always in a tree. And this is something that's culturally different. No one would ever do that here. I don't know. I've never seen it here. People just reuse the bikes. They park them. But I've seen many tree-borne bikes. No real comment. I just thought it was like, you know, maybe the growing pains of trying to grow into these new markets or something.
Growing pains is exactly the word I was going to use. I agree with you. Generally speaking, the users really love the bikes.
It's just some people just, it's a different culture. People are going to treat things differently if they're out there in the public, no matter what.
Then again, you can imagine over the past 2 years, I've met a number of people from a number of different nationalities.
Yeah.
And people, not everyone, but many people often tell me, I love the idea. I use it in China. It's great. I wish it could also be available in my home country, but it just wouldn't work. I go like, why? And because people would
break them,
would break the bikes, would misuse the service and this and this and that. Honestly, personally, that has turned out to just not be true. Countries in which you think the level of, you know, civility or whatever is super high. And people do occasionally do that for whatever reason. And then countries where, you know, you think it's going to be terrible, then actually it works out perfectly because we work with the local communities and we have a PR message and we work with the media and again, working with the government. And if you successfully present the company as a company that wants to help people live better lives, then who's going to say no to that? And like, no one is going to say no to more convenience in their daily life. So, and then the final thing is that when you look at the media, of course, those are the stories that come up because it's so much more fun for, you know, media to talk about this rather than to talk about the thousands of people that ride the bikes every day because it's growing. So you also have to put in perspective the one news you read online compared to the dozens of thousands of daily trips that we have in different countries.
Yeah, exactly. I feel that way. I mean, I see it, but let's talk a little bit about your perspective. Okay. So, now that we're getting closer to the end, and we, you know what, we've gone over on this podcast. I don't care. I've loved this episode. It's been awesome.
Thank you.
And as we're getting into this, I just want to be like, okay, is there still elbow room? You know, someone's listening to this. Someone's like, I want to do the ride share of this. I want to help. Like, is there still elbow room globally? Or is it really still you come to China, you do this, or they can do it now that you've trailblazed? okay, so fast. Would you still recommend a startup, someone who's really passionate about something in this space to follow your path? Is it still opportunity here?
Generally speaking, I want to say yes, of course. I don't see how I could say no, don't come to China to anyone. Whatever the space, the age, the language, the culture, the just whatever. Yeah, like, yes, come to China. You might like it, you might not, but it's going to be amazing.
For what space?
Well, still, come to China. You're going to learn a lot, but it's probably too late. Yeah, it's probably too late.
Really? Tell me about that. It's probably too late for the bike or for the whole rideshare economy.
It's probably too late for a foreign team to come to China now and expect to be a big player in the bike share space.
Mm-hmm. But what about locally in their home country?
Yes. So in that space, there's still a lot of room. And so if anyone's listening and wants to reach out to me, again, my LinkedIn will be in the description below.
It will be there, yes.
Because we're going to more countries. And for example, in Paris, again, my hometown, there's a very ambitious cycling plan that's been put out, I think already a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. That's called Paris 2020 Cycling Capital. Mm. And they want to raise the modal share of cycling from about 5% to where it is right now or last year to 15%. So basically, they want to triple the number of people who use bikes every day. They want to triple the number of bike rides. If you take the existing bike share scheme right now in Paris, Vélib, you would need to have like 10 times more bikes.
You can't support that
number with the existing infrastructure. You need more bikes. They also estimate that there are about 2.7 million daily commutes in Paris that could be done on bicycles. Of course, that would require infrastructure and support and a bunch of stuff. It's not tomorrow that we're going to get 3 million commutes every day on bicycles. But if you take that as a 5 years goal and you do a quick calculation, like you need 50,000 bikes, 100,000 bikes.
Yeah, no, we're
in Paris to be able to meet that figure. Absolutely. Otherwise, like one bike is 100 rides per day, which is just not physically possible. You cannot have that many rides per day per bike. So you just mathematically, you need a lot of bikes. And our goal,
I'm just so excited. I'm like, yes, this is awesome. Keep on going.
Our goal is not to dump as many bikes as possible in the cities. And so if anyone listening is thinking about pictures they might have seen, like this is very important to us. And we've been keeping a close eye on this for a long time. And those bikes are not dead. They're not going to the trash. They're temporarily, and we're talking to the governments to bring them back on the street, if necessary, to another city. Mm-hmm. Like if we already hit the right amount of bikes and we can operate at maximum efficiency, we actually pledged to not put any more new bikes. We'll just replace the old ones.
Yeah.
But so we're working very hard on those pictures that you might have seen. And we definitely don't want that to happen in cities outside of China. But at the same time, if you want, again, to meet the objectives of the government, you need a lot of bikes.
You're going to need a lot of players.
Mathematically.
Yeah, you're going to need a lot of bikes.
You're going to need
a lot of players.
One player that provides the highest
one
quality of service, because it's always easier to talk to one person.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Even if you talk to one company and then they change the person you're talking to, nobody wants that. What everyone wants is one company, one reliable supplier, and one person to talk to. That's what people want.
Yeah.
I'm here to talk.
So then as we're looking at this, I'm going to wrap up with the lightning round questions. And lightning round is going to be the last thing. All right. So, Florian, we have...
Is this
going
to hurt?
Oh, I hope so. Oh, the design. No. So we've talked about like the growth of Mobike and all of this right here. I want to know a little bit about one... Is this what's the future? Is this going to expand into more parts of my life? Am I going to be, using a ride share available, parkless, a car or other things in my life that I can't even imagine right now? Like, how far is this going to go? Or just give me like a quick, this could go how far? What's the next thing I could see online like this?
We've already started going to a ride share. So we're piloting in Guizhou. We announced that a couple of months ago. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's the relationship with Meituan in China, by whom we got acquired for 3.7 billion US a couple of months ago. And they already started their car sharing service.
Yeah.
So there are some connections that you can make from that angle. There is going to be another announcement very soon about Another.
Okay, so there is something, but you can't even say it.
I can't really say it.
Because I want my, like, I want to know if I'm going to be handing off my cell phone in the future and be like, oh, I'm done. I've used my cell phone for the moment, you know, putting it in a booth. Or I could just name all the things in my life that I would have never imagined that I could have this rideshare dockless system. Like, you could expand this so far.
Yeah, you could.
And the entrepreneurs listening, the investors listening, I mean, this is still a frontier where I think the world is accepting right now. Mm-hmm. You know, we're building a better version of how we communicate and move around the world right now. And so there's room for growth, right?
Oh, definitely.
All right.
Definitely.
Room for growth. Cool. You are into sustainability.
Yes.
What are the next moves for you? And how are we going to see you bettering sustainability in the endeavor with Mobike, or for you, are there other projects that you're going to be able to help better the world in that sense?
Scale. On one hand, Mobike again has taught me that if you want to do something, you would rather just go big or go home. Don't go home, but just go big.
Go big, just go big.
And over the past 2 years, I came to realize that there are a number of quotes, but cheesy sentences that people hear. But for me personally, it really took 2 years of Mobike to get it. And Kanye West's famous, reach for the sky. And if you miss, you land on the clouds.
Yeah.
Well, I get that now. Like, I agree. And it still sounds cheesy, but like whatever I do within Mobike, you know, in the coming months, because we've got a bunch of stuff coming up or later in my life, I'm going to keep that in mind. And you know, it might work out, it might not, but like, it's very important to actually believe. It goes back to belief. And if you believe, then you're good.
All right.
And again, it's so cheesy, but it's the truth.
No, I love it. All right. And the last question is just one thing you could, one last piece of advice to any entrepreneur listening. Maybe it was that quote.
Maybe. Imagine, then it's kind of convoluted, but the thing that comes to mind, because what helped me a lot is what would you tell your younger self?
Yeah.
And along those lines, I would tell my younger self, like, go even crazier. I went to China, I did the factories, it was ridiculous, took the bus and the train, I spent 8 hours in traffic to inspect mugs, like it was crazy. As an engineer, and then you send me to a factory to look at like dirty mugs or whatever. But when I look back, I would have done something even crazier, you know, like really? Why not another country or another language or just something crazier? Like the crazier you can think about your future self and then think about what he or she would tell your now self and like double that, just up the ante. And worst thing that can happen is that you'll be a good version of yourself. So
yeah, I love it. Thanks, man. Lauren, this has been one of the best, most fantastic talks. I really, really appreciate
Thank
it.
You
this
so
has
much.
Been killer. Right now, you get to plug yourself, promote. Where do people get a hold of you? Right. How do they find you and get in touch?
LinkedIn is definitely the best way to get in contact with me. I will answer any message that comes to me through LinkedIn with great pleasure. Florian, Florian Bonner, Bohnert. Podcast might be coming soon.
Yeah.
Twitter handle @MobikeFlow. Not very original.
Nice.
And then if anyone is up for a hot wings challenge or some drone flying, I'm also available for that. So let me know.
Awesome. Thanks, man. Thanks so much. It's been a great day.
I appreciate it.
Cheers. Hey everyone, I just want to take a quick moment to thank our sponsor, China Accelerator. They are an accelerator based in Shanghai, bringing international ideas into China and Chinese ideas international. They're number one in what they do. They are a 3-month program and they help build your idea and make it amazingly successful. You can find out more at www.chinaaccelerator.com. People Squared is the original co-working space in China. It's your home for startups, no matter what you're working on. Small team or large, it has all the resources, the environment, the culture, everything that you need to take your idea and make it successful. Founded by Bob Zheng, an entrepreneur himself who really understands what startups need, it's a great place to bring your team and find success. You can find out more at people-squared.com.